Well, it's good to be back with you. We had a good feast in Colorado. It was a long drive getting there and back, but now that our boys are older, we have 4 licensed drivers, it made it a little more tolerable. Today I thought I'd look into a particular thing that perhaps we haven't talked about much in years. You've probably noticed, as I have, that as you're looking at the Bible, you're studying into it, there are a lot of references to farming. There are a number of different individual verses. We see it in the parables of Jesus Christ. And we also see the harvest seasons as a major context for the annual holy days. Now, a lot in the church today have little or no farming background at all. So the concern is, well, if we don't have that kind of background, are we fully grasping the lessons that are being taught? And even those of us who are familiar with farming, we don't have the same experience as what the farming is in Israel. Because there's a different climate in Israel, especially different than what we have here in the Midwest. So consequently, without this background, without this understanding, we might be missing some important points that are being made with the agriculture analogies. So, if we can gain a deeper understanding of the agricultural process in Israel, it could help us have a better basis to understand the spiritual nature of the agricultural lessons that are made by the Bible. So today what I want to do is I want to review the agricultural year, the farming year, in Israel so that we can gain a better understanding of the different agricultural references within the Bible. Now, what do I mean by agricultural year? There are a lot of different ways of defining years, right? I mean, we have our calendar year, which starts in January and ends in December. Our government operates on what's called a fiscal year, and that starts in October and runs through the following September. It's still 12 months, but they're not all the same type of year. We also see this concept in the Bible. As we won't be turning there, but in Exodus 12, verses 1 and 2, when God is explaining the Passover and the first holy days to Moses, he said, "This shall be the first year of the month, the first month of the year for you." So what we have is the holy day year starts in the spring of the year. But we also have the agriculture year. Now, when does that start? Well, it actually starts right after the people would get back from the Feast of Tabernacles in the last great day. I'm not going to turn there to read through it because I got a lot for you. So for the sake of time, in Leviticus 25, we see a lot about the land Sabbath and the Jubilee. Now, one of the interesting things about the Jubilee is that, A, it's also a land Sabbath year. And what we mean by a land Sabbath year is that the crops aren't planted. There's no planting of the crops. There's no harvesting of the crops on a large-scale basis. But the Jubilee year was declared on the Day of Atonement. Now, this makes sense, doesn't it? If you're going to have a land Sabbath year, you're going to proclaim that year prior to anybody going out and planting their crops. Why would you do it in the middle, after everybody's already planted their fields? Why would you go out and say, "Oh, by the way, this is a land Sabbath year, we're not going to work our fields"? So the agricultural year starts after the Feast of Tabernacles. And there's a reason for this. So the first thing we want to take a look at, something that is critical for farming, is rainfall. Rainfall was typically the first indication that the new agricultural year had started. Now, why do we start the year with rainfall? I mean, again, here's the contrast of our experience versus what the climate is in Israel. We have precipitation all 4 seasons, and it's a huge blessing. Well, okay, if you have to go out and shovel and drive in the snow, that may not seem like a blessing, but it's still a blessing. That's moisture that's coming from the sky and coming into the soil. We have 4 seasons. We have precipitation in all 4 of those seasons. The land of Israel does not have four seasons. It only has two. They have a wet season and they have a dry season. And each lasts about 6 months long. Rainfall was absolutely critical for Israel. They have no large freshwater lakes. They have no major rivers except the Jordan, which is way over on the eastern border of the land. So they had to have the rain to supply the moisture to the land, to supply the moisture to all the pools and the streams. And so rain was very critical. Turn with me, if you would, over to Deuteronomy chapter 11. And we'll be looking at verses 10 and 12. Here in Deuteronomy 11, verses 10 through 12, God is telling the Israelites what to expect as they come into this new land. Deuteronomy 11, verses 10 through 12. For the land which you go to possess is not like the land of Egypt from which you have come, where you sowed your seed and watered it by foot as a vegetable garden. But the land which you cross over to possess is a land of hills and valleys, which drinks water from the rain of heaven, a land for which the Lord your God cares. The eyes of the Lord your God are always on it, from the beginning of the year to the very end of the year. See, the land was not like what they experienced in Egypt. Egypt had the Nile River and solely depended on the Nile River for all their irrigation. So they had to manually irrigate all their fields by foot, as if it were a vegetable garden. But not so in Israel. The land depends on the rain. The rain was absolutely necessary to moisten the soil, to replenish the pools and the streams, and to water the fields. Now, one thing to consider, in addition to the rainfall being a vital supply of water for the land, the rainfall is also under God's control. As important as the rainfall is, it's equally important to understand that the rainfall is in His control. And the Israelites had to be reminded of that numerous times. As you study through the Bible, you'll come across a lot of verses which clearly show us that God is in control of the rain. Now, modern scoffers would discount this. They'd say, that's just part of the normal water cycle. Well, to a point, they're correct. But let's remember these two things. God was the one who created the mechanism that set up this water cycle, that established the weather patterns where there would be evaporation and rainfall in other places. So it's still dependent on God. Secondly, God can supernaturally intercede when it's necessary to change what might normally occur in that water cycle so that He can make a point to the people He's trying to teach. Again, while we're here in Deuteronomy 11, look at what God told the Israelites concerning that rainfall. We'll start in verse 13, right where we left off, and go through verse 17. And it shall be that if you earnestly obey my commandments, which I command you today, to love the Lord your God and serve Him with all your heart and with all your soul, then I will give you the rain for your land in its season, the early rain and the latter rain, that you may gather in your grain, your new wine, and your oil. And I will send grass in your fields for your livestock, that you may eat and be filled. Take heed to yourselves, lest your heart be deceived, and you turn aside and serve other gods and worship them, lest the Lord's anger be aroused against you, and He shut up the heavens so there be no rain, and the land yield no produce, and you perish quickly from the good land which the Lord is giving you. God's given them a stern warning. He says, you obey my commandments, you do as I've told you, or I will intercede and prevent the rain. So rainfall is a critical part of the agriculture cycle. So what I'm going to do next is let's start looking at some of the key elements in order of what would happen during the agricultural year. So again, as I said, the agricultural year started with the resumption of rainfall. And this rain is what the Bible refers to as the early rains or the former rains. Sometime after the seventh month of the holy day year, during the feast, after the Feast of Tabernacles is over, there's a change in the prevailing winds. If you remember your geography of Israel, what would happen is the prevailing winds would start to shift. And now they start coming out of a west or southwesterly direction. That means those winds are coming across the Mediterranean Sea. It's picking up the moisture from the evaporated water of the sea, and that begins as rainfall in the land of Israel. The rainfall starts out slowly, a little bit here, a little bit there, but gradually increases over the next few weeks once it starts. Like I said, these are the former rains, the early rains. This is the start of the rainy season. Remember I said there are only two seasons. This is the beginning of the rainy season. And to give you an idea of how rainy it gets, for the next 6 months, there generally are no prolonged periods of fair weather between October and May. There's almost always some form of precipitation coming down. But why are these rains important, these early rains? Well, think about this. After 6 months of no rain at all, what's that soil going to be like? It's hot, dry, compacted. Are you going to be able to plant any seed in that soil? No. What happens is, as these rains start falling, it starts to soften the dirt and makes it possible for the farmers to even begin plowing the fields so they can plant the grain. Turn with me, if you would, over to Psalm 65 and verses 9 and 10. Psalm 65 and verses 9 and 10 shows how important these early rains are and how they start to establish the soil to make it ready. Psalm 65 verses 9 through 10. You visit the earth and water it. You greatly enrich it. The river of God is full of water. You provide their grain, for so you have prepared it. You water its ridges abundantly. You settle its furrows. You make it soft with showers. You bless its growth. This is what God accomplishes with the early rains in Israel. It softens up the soil, prepares it, gets it ready so that the farmers can actually start to do something with it. So what do they do with it? Well, the first thing they have to do is to plow. Once the rain starts to soften the soil, it has to be plowed so that the dirt is in a condition where when they plant the seeds, the roots have something to grab a hold to and they have something to grow into. So let's talk about plowing. First, let's talk about the plowing equipment. What was the plow? What did they use? Well, as we stop and think about what they used as a plow, it's actually very primitive to what we would think of as we use today. The plow was made of two wooden beams, parallel beams, well, mostly parallel, and one end, the front end, was hooked to the yoke of the oxen, because it was the oxen who were pulling the plow through the dirt. At the back part, these two beams, there was a cross beam. And that allowed them to attach the actual plowing pole to the crossbeam to give them some control. The plow piece connected to the back had a little handle up on top so they could hold it and press down. And then on the bottom end, it was basically a long pointed pole. And typically what they would do is they would wrap some sort of metal around the bottom end so that pointed end could actually dig into the dirt. The plow piece was made that way, and it was made in such a way that it's this handle, longer pole, with a sharp pointed end metal at the end. If you look at Isaiah chapter 2 and verse 4, there is a reason for this. Isaiah 2 and verse 4, they read that, "He shall judge between the nations and rebuke many people. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore." So here we have the picture of swords being made into plowshares. And that's pretty much what it was. We also, while we won't turn there, in Joel 3 and verse 10, the reverse situation. They'll turn their plowshares into swords. So what they were doing is they were disconnecting that plow piece from the frame. They could then use that as a sword. There was one other piece of equipment that they used. It's called a goad. Because, face it, if you've ever worked with animals, you know that sometimes they just don't want to cooperate. And there are times when they're out plowing with the oxen figure out, we're done. We don't want to go any further. So the farmer would have to have this long, basically long pointy stick where he'd poke the oxen in the hindquarters to get them to move. Well, they didn't always like that either. Sometimes instead of moving, they'd just kind of kick it like, okay, go away. I don't want you to bother me. We see a reference to this process in Acts chapter 9 and verse 5. Here in Acts 9:5, the context is that this is when Paul is on the road to Damascus. You know, and then he's struck blind by the bright light and stuff. Acts 9:5, Paul's there on the ground, and he said, "Who are you, Lord?" Then the Lord said, "I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting. It's hard for you to kick against the goads." Now, what does that mean? Well, think about it. If the oxen didn't want to move in the forward direction, the farmer would have to start poking him. "Move. I need to plow my field." So they'd kick against the goad, but as they would do that, keep in mind, this is a sharp stick. It hurts. So even oxen can learn that eventually, instead of kicking, I better go in the direction that the farmer wants me to go. And this is the same thing that happened to Paul. Jesus wanted him moving in a particular direction, and he was kicking against it. He didn't want to go that direction. He didn't want to recognize, when you consider how well learned he was in the Scriptures, he didn't want to recognize that this is Jesus Christ. This was the Messiah. And eventually, he had to realize that he had to submit to the will of Jesus Christ and move in the direction that he was being guided. But he didn't like kicking against the goads. So how did they use this plow? I mean, if you got the picture in mind, you've got the oxen up here, you've got the frame, and you've got the plow piece here, and you've got the goad in the other hand. Now, these plows weren't these big plows that turn over dirt like we see today. At best, all they're going to do is scratch the surface, maybe an inch or two, just enough to get that seed in there. So the farmer had to hold that plow piece down. The oxen are pulling it forward. He has to hold it down to keep it in the dirt, but he's also got to keep holding on to the goad. And so we see Jesus Christ's comment in Luke chapter 9 and verse 62. And what did he say here in Luke 9:62? "But Jesus said to him, 'No one, having put his hand to the plow and looking back, is fit for the kingdom of God.'" Imagine, the man is out here working this plow. He's pushing down. He's guiding, goading and guiding both the oxen. If he's looking back, what does that do to his furrows? They start going all over the place, don't they? This is why Jesus said, don't look back. You've got a direction. You've got a task ahead of you. Keep focused on it. Focus your energies. Focus your whole being on getting that job done. Now, once the plowing was done, what's next? Well, we got the seed to plant. And how was that done? The grain that was planted in the fall was going to be barley and wheat. Because you plant it in the fall, it grows a little bit, goes dormant in the wintertime, then comes back in the spring. So, barley and wheat are the crops that are referred to as first fruits. So when you see references in the Bible to the first fruits, and we see them in an agricultural reference to the wheat and the barley, that's us. Those are analogies that apply to us, because we are called to become the first fruits. Now, the barley and wheat were planted at the same time of year, but because they have different maturing times, they would be harvested about a month apart, the barley first and then the wheat. when the farmer was sowing the seed, what he would do is he would carry a bag of grain with him, scoop his hand in, and just kind of broadcast it out. And there's still some things today that are planted that way. It's just the broadcaster's on the back of a tractor and it spews it out. But this leads to some interesting things. The seed wouldn't always land in what we would think of as an ideal location. Because there are a couple characteristics about this field that we might not understand, because it's not the case for us today. And we see that. First, we'll start in Luke chapter 6 and verse 1. So the first characteristic we want to look at is referenced here. Luke chapter 6 and verse 1. Now it happened on the second Sabbath, after the first, that he went through the grain fields, and his disciples plucked the heads of grain and ate them, rubbing them in their hands. Why are they out walking in a grain field? Were they just meandering through this field for some reason? Well, no, actually, they weren't. They were actually on a, well, for lack of a better word, they were on a road, a footpath. See, prior to the Romans coming in and conquering the land, there were no really true roads. The Romans started building roads because it made it easier for them to move their troops from one place to the other. Before that, when people wanted to travel from one city to another, they would travel on commonly used footpaths. And these footpaths frequently would go right through the middle of a field. And so this is what Jesus and his disciples were doing. They weren't out just walking through a field. They were on a path which went through a field, and they were able to pluck the grains as they're walking by. These paths are the wayside. When you look at the parable of the sower, and it says some of the seed fell on the wayside. That's what it's talking about. These footpaths that people commonly use to walk from one place to the other. And because they walked on them on a regular basis, they were packed down, they were hard. It made no sense whatsoever for the farmer to even try to till up that dirt with the primitive plow that he had. So these little roads constantly went through the field. So you can understand why when the seed fell on the wayside, it wouldn't germinate. It couldn't get into the soil. It's basically almost as like if you're throwing seed down on a concrete sidewalk. That's how hard the paths were. And this was not a new thing either. Let me give you a reference in Deuteronomy 23, verse 25, God actually established a law that would allow travelers, as they're walking through these paths, to pick the grain for a quick snack on the road, so to speak. They weren't allowed to harvest. They weren't allowed to go in there with a sickle and say, oh, I'm just happen to go through here and take a bunch. But they could pick a few head grains. So in Deuteronomy 23:25, when you come into your neighbor's standing grain, you may pluck the heads with your hand, but you shall not use a sickle on your neighbor's standing grain. It's not like he's saying, well, if you just randomly happen to find yourself in a field, go ahead and eat of it. No, it's as they're walking through on these footpaths. The second characteristic of a field that might seem a little odd to us, we also see referenced in the parable of the sower. Jesus speaks of seeds falling among the thorns. Now, why would you have thorns in your field? I mean, they're noxious weeds, aren't they? Thistles, some of these thistles we have around here, you can't get rid of them. Even if there's just that much root that you leave. Hey, whoa, there they are again. Thanks. But no, there are thorns at the edge of the field. And so as the farmer is broadcasting the seed, some of it falls among the thorns. But why were they there? Why didn't they get rid of them? Well, they weren't like the herbaceous thistles and stuff that we have. These are actually woody type of thorn bushes. And they left them there for a very good reason. Because in the dry season, when they're out in the pastures with their flocks and herds, they would cut those thorns down and use them as firewood to cook their meals, to provide heat for the night. So there was a reason for keeping the thorns at the edge of the field. And again, in Exodus 22, verse 6, God takes this into account. It's part of the law in Exodus 22, verse 6. If fire breaks out and catches in thorns, so that stacked grain, standing grain, or the field is consumed, He who kindled the fire shall surely make restitution. So we have a better understanding of that, knowing that the farmers kept these thorns at the edge of the field because they used them later when they're out with their animals. So we've had the early rains, and that allowed the farmers to get their plowing done and to get the sowing of the grain done. But they wanted to make sure that all that planting was finished before mid-December. Because now, starting in mid-December, was when the second division of rainfall would start. The winds would start shifting, and they start coming out of the north. They're cold winds, and they're moist winds. And what happens is, as those fronts move down across Israel, there would be high-pressure weather systems sitting over Africa. So these rainstorms come in, and then they just stall. They can't move anywhere because the high-pressure systems are stopping them. And they're cold and wet, and they would rain 4 or 5 days in a row. Temperatures would be getting down into the low 40s, sometimes even low enough, where I think back 2 years ago, Jerusalem had like a foot of snow in December. You don't want to be out there trying to plant the rest of your seed in there, and you certainly don't want to be out there with your flocks. No respectable shepherd is going to be out in mid to late December with his sheep in pouring rain that's freezing cold, because he won't be out there with his sheep for very long. So this is another indication that the myth of Christ's birth in December is false. Those shepherds were out in their fields. They wouldn't be out there in December. But as miserable as these heavy rains are, they're extremely critical to the land, because it's the heavy rains that provided the primary moisture for the crops, particularly for the grains. Without these rains, the grain wouldn't grow, and there'd be no crop to harvest. These rains were also critical for supplying and replenishing the water supply, you know, all the various pools and the streams that were in Israel. And this was actually the water that was used throughout the rest of the year, once the dry season came in. So they needed these heavy rains. And again, that would start in December. And then, beginning in early to mid-February, the heavy rains would start to taper off. And we get into a period of rain that the Bible refers to as the latter rains. This begins the third division of the raining season, and it's referred to as the latter rains. And it would start falling about early March. Now, the rainfall amount wasn't as much as the heavy rains just ended, but again, we have to have these latter rains because that supplied the moisture for the grain crops to mature. They weren't to the point where they're growing so much anymore, but those seed heads had developed and the grain had to mature. Now, the barley starts to mature in the latter part of March, and then the wheat crop needs the rains so that the grain heads can actually develop better, and then it starts to mature about a month later. But the latter rains were also critical for providing moisture to the pasture lands, to the outlying fields, because once that moisture was in those fields and stayed in there, that's what greened up the pastures. That's what allowed the shepherds, the farmers, to go out later with their animals to graze them. It was also during this time, because the latter rains were not as heavy, that they would go out and they would plant the millet, the peas, the lentils, and the melons, and the cucumbers, which would be harvested later in the summer. So as the latter rains are coming down and starting to come to an end, this brings us to the grain harvest, the harvest of the first fruits. During the days of unleavened bread, as you may remember, there's a special ceremony observed on the Sunday that falls during the week, the 7 days of unleavened bread. And that, of course, is the wave sheaf offering. You can see that referenced in Leviticus 23 and verses 10 through 14. We're not going to go ahead and read through that, but this was critical because the Israelites were instructed that they were not to begin to harvest the barley or to use the barley until the first of the first fruits was harvested and offered to God as the wave sheaf. And so you see that in Leviticus 23, verses 10 to 14. both grains, the barley and the wheat, are called first fruits because as you look at the agricultural year, that's the first food harvest that there was. Now, there was a harvest early in the year because they had flax, but the flax was harvested primarily for the fibers to create the linens that they used. It wasn't a food crop. So the first food crop to be harvested were the barley and the wheat. They were the first fruits. The harvest season would start with the wave sheaf offering and would actually end typically around the time of Pentecost. And the two would run together. They'd harvest the barley and then the wheat. But what does it take to harvest grain? Again, we take it for granted because as we look out in the fields and we see these huge combines going up and down the field, there are actually multiple steps to harvesting grain. But when we look at a combine, it's all done right there within one machine. And the equipment we have is so efficient that a farmer can go out with one of those and easily, if the weather conditions are right, can harvest 100 acres or more per day. That wasn't the case in Israel. They couldn't wait until there were amber waves of grain. They had to have some clue as to when they could start harvesting. So the first step to harvesting the grain is cutting the grain. We've already referred to this a little bit. They would go out with hand sickles and cut the stalks of the grain off near the ground there. But they couldn't wait until the grain was actually ripe, mature. What they had to do is look for a clue that the grain was ready. And we see a reference to that in John chapter 4 and verse 35. John chapter 4 and verse 35, Jesus is saying here, "Do you not say there are still 4 months and then comes the harvest? Behold, I say to you, lift up your eyes and look at the fields, for they are already white for harvest." What does that mean? White for harvest. You know, we're used to the golden color of the wheat. Now it's ready for harvest. What this is that as the grain is maturing, there's a certain point where the seed heads get this whitish color to them instead of green. And the farmers knew that once it reached that point, even if the grain was cut, it would still mature. So that's how they knew the field was ready for harvest, because it turned white. And Jesus knew this, and he referenced this. So they'd go out and they'd cut the stalks and leave it lying there on the field. Then comes the next step. They have to be gathered up. So a group of workers would come in behind the cutters and they'd gather up the stalks and bundle them into sheaves. And these sheaves we see referenced, don't necessarily have to turn there in Genesis 37, verse 7. But you remember Joseph had two dreams. And wisely or not, he told his brothers. But one of the dreams was that they're out harvesting the grain. And they were bundling the grain up into their sheaves, and the sheaves that his brothers had gathered together bowed down to his. That's what they're talking about, gathering up the stalks of grain into sheaves. Now, the grain wasn't mature yet, so they couldn't immediately take it and start processing it. What they would do, though, is they would stack the sheaves in a pile that was a conical-shaped pile, so that if there was any more rain and any dew, it would just run off the sheaves down into the field. That would allow the grain to continue maturing and it would keep the moisture off of it so that it wouldn't rot while it's still out there in the field. So we have the cutting of the grain, the bundling into sheaves, and then the next step is the threshing. Threshing is the process of detaching the grain from the stalks and the seed head. The stalks were used later for straw, but obviously the main focus of threshing was to get the grain. That's food. So they wanted to get the grain away from it. Now the threshing floor, it could be an actual structure in some circumstances, but more often than not, what they would do is that they would pack down an area sweep it off to get rid of any loose stones and pebbles and stuff, and any loose dust that they could. And they would use that as the threshing floor. Now, how do they thresh the grain? Well, there are three primary ways that they used. To take a look at one, let's go back to the book of Ruth. Ruth chapter 2 and verse 17. Because you remember, Ruth was out gleaning in the barley fields, and then later the wheat. So she's picking up any stray stalks and stuff, or grains that had been dropped by the gatherers. You know, face it, you're gathering up all these stalks and stuff, you're not going to get every one of them as you're creating your sheaves. Some might fall out here. And that's what the gleaners would look for. So Ruth is out here gleaning. And in chapter 2, verse 17, we see, so she gleaned in the field until evening and beat out what she had gleaned. And it was about an ephah of barley. So she beat it out. One of the means they used for threshing was to have a long, flexible stick, and they literally would beat the grain with that stick. And eventually the grain would separate from the stalks and the seed heads. But this wasn't the preferred way, because that is a lot of hard work. Now, the gleaners would do this because they weren't gathering up that much at one time, so they could use the flails to thresh the grain. But for large-scale harvest, what they would usually do is they would actually bring the sheaves into the threshing floor area, and then they would have their oxen moving around. They would drive their oxen around so that the oxen are trampling on the stalks and the grain heads. The hooves of the oxen would then actually cut the grain out of the seed heads without really damaging it. And we see a reference to this, a couple references actually. Let's turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and verses 7 to 9. Here in 1 Corinthians 9 verses 7 to 9, Paul is talking about a principle that those who work should also share in the benefits. But he references something back in Deuteronomy 25:4. Paul writes here in 1 Corinthians 9, verses 7 to 9, "Whoever goes to war at his own expense, who plants a vineyard and does not eat of its fruit, or who tends a flock and does not drink of the milk of the flock, do I say these things as a mere man? Or does not the law say the same also? For it is written in the law of Moses," and he's quoting Deuteronomy 25 verse 4 here, "you shall not muzzle an ox while it treads out the grain." Is it oxen that God is concerned about? That's what he's talking about here. The oxen threshing the grain from the stalks and the seed heads. Now, one other method that they used, it wasn't quite as prevalent, but it was used occasionally, is instead of using just the oxen, they would put together three or four planks, and so that it was about 3 feet wide, maybe 6 feet long. They would put holes in the planks, and then they would drive sharp rocks in the hole. In this way, they created what's called a threshing sled. They would then hook that up to the oxen, and a man would ride on the back and then drive the oxen around. So in addition to the oxen's hooves threshing the grain, you also have this sled going across the grain, breaking the grain out from the seed heads and the stalks. The Romans had a version of this. Instead of using rocks, they'd use iron to give you an indication of the action that this sled took, the net effect of it. The name for the Roman threshing sled was called the tribulum, which comes from the same root word that we have for tribulation. That's how brutal these sleds were in cutting across the stalks and the grain, because they wanted to get that grain completely separated from the seed heads. Now, once that happened, then we get to the next step. And the next step is winnowing. Winnowing is a process that uses wind to separate the different components. Because think about it, now you've got this big pile of grain, you've got the heavy grain, you've got the chaff from the seed heads, and you've got the straw. They all weigh different weights. The grain is very dense, the other two aren't. So they would use what's called a winnowing fan or a winnowing fork They'd scoop up the grain and just toss it in the air. The wind would then catch it, the grain being the heaviest part, would just fall right back down. The chaff and the straw would be blown downwind, and that could be collected later. You had to have wind, though. And primarily, this was done towards evening, because that's the time of day that they could count on a consistent, steady breeze that would allow them to do the winnowing. And we also see a reference to that. Let me read that to you. It's back in Ruth chapter 3 and verse 2. Ruth 3:2. Naomi is talking to Ruth, and she says, "Now Boaz, whose young women you were with, is he not our relative? In fact, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor." Because you might think, well, why is he there at night? Well, it actually is more, is there evening. You still had enough light where you could see what you're doing. And they may have had some torches there too. But there was a steady wind at that time of day. So that's why he's at the threshing floor, to do the winnowing, to be able to separate the grain. Also, when it comes to winnowing, and this is a critical aspect of winnowing. It's an act of separating the first fruits from what is not desirable, the chaff and the straw. Turn with me, if you would, to Luke chapter 3 and verses 16 through 17. John the Baptist is talking here in Luke 3 and verses 16 through 17. Verse 16, "John answered, saying to all, I indeed baptize you with water, but one mightier than I is coming, whose sandal strap I am not worthy to loose. He will baptize you with the Holy Spirit and fire. His winnowing fan is in his hand, and he will thoroughly clean out his threshing floor and gather the wheat into his barn, but the chaff he will burn with unquenchable fire." This is just one of the statements that clearly shows that Jesus Christ, when he returns, will take a winnowing fan to those who've been called as first fruits. So we want to make sure that we're part of the grain, not part of the stalks, not part of the chaff. There are a number of other places where Jesus talks about needing to create a separation. The sheep and the goats, and the wheat and the tares, which we'll discuss brief next section. There will be a separation, and we want to make sure that we're on the right side of that separation. The next and final step of the grain harvest is the sifting. Once the grain was separated and is now apart, they had to do sifting. And what would happen is women and children would take these huge baskets. They would take the grain and they kind of look through it and stuff, because if there was any small pebbles or stones that were still in the grain, obviously you want to get rid of those. You don't want to be trying to grind those up with your wheat to make bread. But there's one other thing. They had to decide what to keep and what to discard. One other thing that they had to be very careful to look at, and I already referenced it, the parable of the wheat and the tares. We're not going to read through that, but that's in Matthew 13 and verses 24 through 30. The word translated as tares comes from a Greek word for a plant known as darnel. It's a type of grass. And it grows like a weed in various parts of Europe and Asia. And the darnel plants are so similar in appearance to wheat plants that in some areas it's actually referred to as false wheat. It's only after the seed heads appear that you can start to distinguish between the wheat and the tares. Because the darnel would have a dark seed, the wheat has a light seed. The reason the women had to sift and look for these darnel seeds is because of the very nature of that seed. When consumed, Darnell can cause dizziness, vomiting, drowsiness, and in some cases, it can even lead to death. So you can see how important this process of sifting was to separate out what was good in the first fruits and what was bad. Let's take a look at Luke chapter 22 and verse 31. Luke 22, verse 31. And the Lord said, Simon, Simon, indeed Satan has asked for you that he may sift you as wheat. Well, what does that mean? Satan wanted to sift them as wheat. And, by extension, he would like to sift us as wheat. Satan wanted to be the one who decides who is acceptable as a first fruit and who is not. Can you imagine the outcome if he were given that responsibility? Secondly, and even more importantly, still, in his arrogance, Jesus Christ was being asked to give Satan his judgment seat. Satan is still trying to replace Jesus Christ as the judge of the brethren. All because of this reference here to sifting you as wheat, we see that Satan still wants to be the one who makes that decision when that decision rightfully belongs to Jesus Christ. So that's generally what it took to harvest the grains. Cutting the plants, binding them as sheaves, threshing those sheaves, winnowing the grain away from the chaff and the straw, and then the final action was the sifting of the grain to make sure that anything impure would be removed from there before the first fruits were gathered into the barns. So let's talk about those first fruits just a little bit. The first was the barley. It would start in the first month, about, as we said, at the times of the days and leavened bread. They had to wait for the wave sheaf offering. The harvest of the barley would continue into the second month. It would take 3, maybe 4 weeks for them to get through all the fields of the barley. And roughly about 30 days. But it was a food grain, but it wasn't as highly valued as a food grain. In fact, in good times, it was actually used more as a grain for the livestock because they didn't have things like oats or rye. It was a lower valued grain, so that's something you feed to the livestock. And you'll see a reference to that. You can just jot that down in 1 Kings chapter 4 and verse 28. They also brought barley and straw to the proper place for the horses and steeds, each man according to his charge. So we see they're feeding the barley to their livestock. But in addition to being for livestock, it was also one of the primary grains for the very poor in the society. Its value was not even close to what the value of wheat was. And in fact, we see a number of references where barley cost half of what the wheat did. Let me give you those references. 2 Kings chapter 7, and you'll see that in verses 1, 16, and 18. Just to quote from one of those, 2 seahs of barley for a shekel and 1 seah of fine flour, which is from the wheat, for a shekel, shall be sold tomorrow at this time. So, the wheat cost twice as much as what the barley did. Now, after about 30 days, the barley harvest would be finished. But at that point, the wheat was ready to start harvesting. But at the same time, we again see a shift in our weather patterns. Now the winds are starting to shift, and they're starting to come out of the west. Well, what is to the west of Israel? Hot, dry, arid lands. There is no moisture for evaporation. So now we start a period of 6 months where there is no rain in Israel. That's part of their climate. And that started at the beginning of the wheat harvest. So the wheat harvest would start right after the barley and last until Pentecost. And those weather patterns would change. And it would stay dry again until after the Feast of Tabernacles, when those early rains would start up again. So think about that. As you're harvesting your wheat, how odd it would be if there's a thunderstorm, if there's rain coming down on your wheat harvest. This doesn't happen. We see that, though, in 1 Samuel chapter 12 and verses 16 through 18. This, again, comes back to our earlier point that God can control the rainfall and use it when He needs to get a point across. 1 Samuel chapter 12 and verses 16 to 18. Remember, the Israelites had asked for a king. Samuel was very displeased. Obviously, God was very displeased that they had done this, because God is their king. So we read here in 1 Samuel 12 and verses 16 through 18. Now, Samuel's talking to the Israelites. Now, therefore, stand and see the great thing which the Lord will do before your eyes. Is today not the wheat harvest? I will call to the Lord, and He will send thunder and rain, that you may perceive and see that your wickedness is great, which you have done in the sight of the Lord in asking a king for yourselves. So Samuel called to the Lord, and the Lord sent thunder and rain that day. And all the people greatly feared the Lord and Samuel. Why? Because it does not rain during the wheat harvest. And here was a clear sign of God's displeasure at what they had just done. It's not an ordinary shower. Clearly, a sign from God that you have displeased me. So that brings us to the end of the harvest of the first fruits. It's now hot, dry. We're going into the summer months. They'll harvest on small scale the cucumbers and the melons and stuff that they had planted back in the early part of the year. But the next major harvest doesn't come until toward the end of summer. It's the fruit harvest. And the things that they would harvest from the fruit harvest primarily included dates, figs, pomegranates, grapes, which they pressed into wine, and olives, which they pressed to produce their oil. Now, of this fruit harvest, the grapes and the olives were by far the larger harvest of all the fruits. And this entire harvest at the end of the summer greatly exceeded what they brought in the spring. And we see that pictured in God's holy days. Harvest of the first fruits, those of us who are being called now, is a smaller harvest. But in the fall, when Jesus Christ returns, when Satan is put away, think about the great, immense harvest of people who are going to be brought up in the second resurrection. And that's what this fruit harvest pictures. Look at Exodus chapter 23 and verses 15 through 16. There are other verses which refer to this, but I wanted to go here particularly. Exodus 23, verses 15 through 16. You shall keep the feast of unleavened bread, and you shall eat unleavened bread 7 days, as I commanded you, at the time appointed in the month of Abib. For in it you came out of Egypt. None shall appear before me empty. And the feast of harvest, talking about Pentecost, the first fruits of your labor, which you have sown in the field. And the feast of ingathering, at the end of the year, when you have gathered in the fruit of your labors from the field. Feast of Tabernacles, also called the Feast of Ingathering, was pictured by this huge harvest of fruit, and particularly the grapes and the olives. It was an exceedingly great harvest in the years when they were following God, and He blessed the land with the rain. So we've covered a lot, as I'm sure your hands are telling you. There's no way to go through all the verses that refer to agriculture and the parables and so forth, but the Bible does make a lot of references to farming. It makes a lot of references to the things that are done as part of the farming year. And there's considerable symbolic meaning to that that God gives us in His Word. Meaning to His feasts, to His parables, and to the other analogies that are used within the pages. For example, God's Word itself is in some areas depicted as rainfall and as seed. And the church is referred to as the first fruits. And there are a lot of other examples. We see them as we study throughout the entire pages. So what I was hoping to do today is by going over this agricultural year, by talking about, you know, how it starts, what's necessary, the steps that they take in processing the harvest and what the harvests are, that as you go back and do your studies and look at these things, perhaps now you'll have a better understanding of what the reference means and what that means for us and what God is trying to teach us now with His Word. So as we read and study the Bible, understanding this yearly farming cycle can give us further insights into understanding the things that we need to learn from the Bible examples that God has given us.